for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The House passes a $1 trillion spending bill hours before the midnight deadline, averting a government shutdown. In a rare public press conference, CIA Director John Brennan says the Senate report on interrogations is flawed, and protests continue over grand jury decisions not to indict police officers. Here for the week's top national stories on the Friday News Roundup, John Dickerson of Slate, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg News, and John Prideaux of The Economist. And since it's Friday, you can watch a live video stream of the program on our website, drshow.org. And welcome to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Thanks for having us.
Good to see you all. Before we dive into the news, I want to let listeners know that they can have a turn at the mic. They can ask me a question in a new feature. It's called What Else? Ask Diane. You can find our Q&A on Facebook at facebook.com/The Diane Rehm Show. I'll look forward to that. Now, John Dickerson, the House passed a spending bill just before midnight deadline. The vote, 219-206. How did that all break down?
Well, it broke down in a very messy, tense, raucous process in which you had battles both within the Republican side between conservatives and kind of pragmatists. And then on the Democratic side, you had a fight that included basically an open fight between Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi in the House and the president. Nancy Pelosi was pushing Democrats to vote against it. The president was pushing Democrats to vote for it. This was an event in the twilight between two Congresses. It's dealing with the last business of the last Congress, a real push, got to get the government to stay open. The president made the case that the economy would be hurt if this $1.1 trillion spending package wasn't passed. So it's the kind of messy business of the old and the fights, the coalitions, and the tensions within the parties are a part of the new Congress, and we're going to see a lot of that in the coming year.
And Lisa, certainly Senator Elizabeth Warren and others did not like what's in that bill.
Right. Senator Elizabeth Warren objected to a provision that would deal with Wall Street regulation. And it's a little complicated, but basically it would ban banks from having certain risky derivatives trades in units that are backed by the FDIC, so taxpayer dollars. So this was something that Wall Street found very onerous. It was something that was included in Dodd-Frank, largely as to help then-Senator Blanche Lincoln win her re-election battle. So it was included in that bill. It was watered down, and banks had been fighting it for 4 or 5 years. They wanted out. They got their way in the Cromnibus bill that was passed last night. Elizabeth Warren said they shouldn't get their way, that there should be stricter consumer protections. But really what this was about wasn't so much this provision, but a proxy fight for what's happening in the Democratic Party. What you see now in the wake of this midterm schlacking, as seems to be the term of art that we're calling their midterm Democratic midterm losses, Democrats are having this big battle over the future of their party. Do they try to go and win centrist, which is what a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters are saying, or do they take a different approach and go really aggressive populist economic policy, which is what folks like Elizabeth Warren are saying? So that's what this was about. And what was most interesting was that Pelosi sided with Elizabeth Warren against the president. So as John pointed out, that was a fascinating dynamic, and the one that I think everyone will be watching very closely as we go into the next year, not only in the next Congress, but in terms of what it means for Hillary Clinton's presidential bid.
John Prideaux, how do you see it?
Well, I'm pleased there's not going to be another government shutdown. I feel like we've had enough of those to last a little while. So I think that's a good thing. I also think that people in Washington often decry the lack of bipartisanship around this town. And in fact, this bill was bipartisan to some extent. You had a very interesting form of bipartisanship, as Lisa says, in the sense that you had Elizabeth Warren Democrats voting with Tea Party Republicans on one side, and on the other you had, you know, Democrats and Republicans voting together to keep the government open. That's interesting, and that's a good thing in a way. I think it's good when parties don't all vote as blocs. That said, I find it troubling that members of the House had so little time to consider the bill. There wasn't much time between it being published and it being voted on. I think somebody figured out that if all House members sat down and read it, which they probably didn't, they would have about a page to read every minute, and there was some pretty fiddly stuff in there. And there was also obviously some odd things that were rammed in there at the last minute. We talked a little bit about the derivatives stuff, whether you oppose that or think it was a good idea. The fact that the language seems to have been written by bank lobbyists is troubling, I think.
Lisa.
But gosh, was it messy. I mean, this was kind of, the process was so messy. This is like if you don't study all semester, you do nothing in your class, and you get to the final exam, and you got to cram. And yeah, maybe you'll pass, but it's going to be really, really ugly. There's going to be all-nighters, and that's what we saw here. And so what ended up happening was the least productive Congress in history tried to do everything at the very end, and they passed this $1 trillion, 1,600-page bill that did a whole host of things. They rewrote campaign finance laws, rewrote
so
Wall Street provisions.
So wealthy donors get to give more.
Yeah, well-paid donors get to give as much as 10 times as much to party committees. So that means, and it's for very specific things. It's for funding conventions and legal challenges and improving offices. But still, it's a major increase in how much wealthy donors can give. They overruled a law that was passed in the District of Columbia decriminalizing marijuana. They cut EPA funding. They created new manufacturing networks. They funded the entire government, except, you know, only the DHS for a portion. So they're doing a lot of really big things in a really crunched short period of time. And you do have to wonder how much scrutiny all these measures really are getting.
Almost none. And you remember there were two things. It's basically, we had an election which the public said we are disappointed with the way Washington works. And then, as if to celebrate that, Washington worked in all of the ways that are disappointing to the American people. I mean, there was, remember, a big push by Republicans to make it so that there would be 3 days to evaluate bills. Well, that didn't happen in this case. There was a big push by Republicans when Democrats were in the control of the House to say it's unconscionable for no member of Congress, it's unconscionable when members of Congress don't read the complete text of a bill. Well, that certainly didn't happen in this case. And then we have these individual provisions, and it will create seeds of anger. And we were talking about the donations, the increased donations and the powers of the party. Well, here's a way in which the politics affects, or the policy affects the politics. The conservative Tea Party members on the Republican side see that as a power grab by the establishment in the Republican Party, because the more money the parties have, the more they can do their, you know, machinations, and the less power the grassroots has. That's the way the Tea Party folks see it. So that's, there are the seeds of future anger riddled throughout this bill.
Tell me what happens to pensions, John.
Well, there it's not clear exactly what happens with pensions, and I haven't actually looked at what finally passed. But there is a provision that changes the treatment of pensions for pensions that are basically going broke, and that it allows those who are over 75. Have their pensions protected. But for other pensions that are going broke, they are allowed to cut the payout. And in some cases, for some of those who would be affected, your pension could drop. If it's $2,500 a month, it could be cut in half.
Wow. John Perdue.
Yeah, it's particular types of pensions, as I understand it, that have some kind of implicit guarantee from the taxpayer. And the fund that is meant to provide this guarantee doesn't have much money in it. And also, some of these pensions are in bad shape. So clearly something needs to be done here.
Are these public pensions?
They're public in the sense that they enjoy some sort of public guarantee, but they're not necessarily people who work for, you know, for government, right?
Exactly, which is why I'm so confused by the whole notion that these pensions are somehow affected. And then the question becomes, what's the Senate going to do with all this, Lisa?
Well, Senator Harry Reid said that they, you know, they passed a two-day extension to give them more time, so they have today and tomorrow to get something through and stave off a shutdown. Senator Harry Reid seems to think that the Senate will be able to do that. And the dynamics, of course, in the Senate are different than the dynamics in the House. So I suspect that we won't be headed towards a shutdown anytime soon. But I think there is, you know, although this was messy and probably wasn't very good, it will impact a lot of people and probably wasn't all that great for democracy, there are some really interesting political dynamics that are worth watching. And one, which John alluded to, was the sort of alliance, the political alliance between the Tea Party right and the progressive left. And we saw them being on the same page, not only on the Wall Street regulation, but also, as John mentioned, on the campaign finance, opposing the increase in campaign finance limits to party committees. And I think that does speak to something that we've seen a lot in polling as this undercurrent in politics, which is this distrust of the American people of, you know, big business, big banks, Wall Street, feeling that the system is rigged somehow. And you see the parts of each party trying to capitalize on those feelings.
Lisa Lehrer, she is White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. John Prideaux of The Economist. John Dickerson, he's chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine, political director for CBS. Short break. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity. Now with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. More at Lumosity.com. From Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems, in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Welcome back to the National Hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with John Prideaux of The Economist, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg News, John Dickerson of Slate and CBS. And you can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org. I hope you'll tune in so you can see the show as well as listen to it. All right, we're on to the report about the use of certain techniques to glean information. CIA Director John Brennan is the latest to speak out. Let's hear what he had to say.
I have already stated that our reviews indicate that the detention and interrogation program produced useful intelligence that helped the United States thwart attack plans, capture terrorists, and save lives. But let me be clear. We have not concluded that it was the use of EITs within that program that allowed us to obtain useful information from detainees subjected to them. the cause and effect relationship between the use of EITs and useful information subsequently provided by the detainee is, in my view, unknowable.
What a term, John Prideaux, unknowable.
I thought that was very interesting. I mean, this report, the headlines suggested that the report kind of proved that torture didn't work. In fact, I think what John Brennan is saying is we don't really know. Therefore, torture is a really bad idea because it's not useful. But I think that, in a way, distracts from the main argument, which is that America ought not to be torturing people because that's not who we are. I mean, I think if it was just a question of utility, then that's one argument, but it's clearly not. I imagine there might be cases in which torture could be effective. I can imagine some. But even so, we ought not to do it. I thought Senator McCain gave a very fine speech in the Senate a couple of days ago when he said that torture compromises that which most distinguishes us from our enemies. And he seems right about that.
And fascinating that Brennan never used the word torture, but continually used EIT, shorthand for
Enhanced Interrogation Techniques. And that's what we saw all week long, which is people couldn't even agree on the terms. And what Brennan, and also when you heard him say that the interrogation program yielded useful information, well, there's a fuzziness there. Yes, but interrogation program could just be simply asking a fellow what he did, and then he tells you. So there was a lot of, and that's different from whether torture created or gave good information to an intelligence officials. And the Democratic majority on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence went point by point through a series of instances in which they said the following intelligence was found in the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and it was all found before the torture began. And then the pushback came from the former directors of the Central Intelligence Agency, and even a little bit from within the agency. And this was the fine line John Brennan was trying to walk, trying to deal with all of his different constituencies, trying not to contradict the president who talked about torture, recognizing past abuses, but also not trying to demolish the morale of the people still working at the CIA. But the pushback from those who were there during the Bush years was that that in fact this information had been useful in several important ways. And that's one of the central debates here, aside from, of course, the moral one.
Lisa.
I think Brennan was in a lot of ways just trying to turn the page and move forward, say, okay, we had this report, now let's kind of move past it. And I thought one of his most interesting remarks was about transparency, which, of course, was an argument for that Senator Feinstein had for doing this whole report. And he said, I think there's more than enough transparency that's happened over the last couple of days. I think it's over the top. And in part because the politics of this is really tough. It's particularly tough for President Obama. You know, he's spent 6 years resisting pressure from activists to pursue people responsible for these advanced interrogation techniques. And now he's in this position where he has to deflect questions about whether whether torturing was effective, if anyone should be punished. And it's his own caucus, of course, in the Senate that's hammering him for keeping the director, John Brennan. So he's just in a tough spot. And I think the politics of this are really hard on both sides of the equation. So you see a lot of politicians saying, all right, we have it out there. Let's just sort of, all right, you know, let's just look over here now.
You know, to say that what Brennan wants us to do is simply move on, get over it, in effect. I don't think I, as an American, can get over it that easily.
And that's the problem for the politicians, right? The reports were startling. They were horrifying. The description of these techniques was extremely graphic. So you don't have, particularly with 2016 candidates, this is something they're going to have to answer. And it's not going to be easy for them. If you're a Republican, you don't want to be defending these graphic techniques, but at the same time, you don't want to be soft on terrorism. If you're Hillary Clinton, you have to be tough on national security, but you also have a party base that wants you to not only condemn these tactics, but have some consequences, punish people.
Dan, I just wanted to pick up about something what you said at the beginning about how we've talked about these things, enhanced interrogation techniques, sort of makes them sound quite pleasant. I mean,
exactly.
If something's enhanced,
exactly.
Then that suggests it's better.
Right.
A technique sort of brings to mind, you know, an improvement to someone's golf swing. And then when you change it to an acronym and it's an EIT, you know, who can be against three little letters like that? It's a very interesting example of how a sort of abusive language can make it easier for people to do bad things, because you know, people just talk about EITs and enhanced. When, you know, what we mean is simulated drowning, you know, the forced rectal feeding, all sorts of kind of horridness.
And I must say, I was somewhat horrified that psychologists were hired and ultimately paid $81 million,
two military psychologists were put at the center of this. And what the report describes, and even some in the CIA now and in the past say one of its problems was that these psychologists and the whole thing was put together from scratch, and that the kind of pell-mell rush to figure out how to do this led to a lot of the abuses or line crossings, and the psychologists were the ones that came up with these techniques, kind of making them up on the fly. I wanted to go back to this point about how we talk about this, and particularly the candidates that are running for president in the future. To the extent that this is useful, having this report out, it is an analysis of a very dark time and a very dark business in a kind of more reasoned fashion, when the heat of the moment, when it is not a ticking time bomb, so that policymakers can think clearly about the moral values that sometimes get sublimated in a time of crisis. When we're electing people to be the president, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, the entire point is to test them about how they would think in moments of crisis, to find out what their values are, so that we have that on the record, so that when the moment comes, there is something against which we can judge their actions in the moment against the previous things they've said about their values and ideals. And ducking the question, chickening out on the question, seems to me to be a core failure of any candidate running for president.
Well, he's not running for president, but Vice President Cheney certainly did not duck out on any of these questions, John.
No, he didn't. And it's been interesting to see that even with the horrible things we've had detailed in the report, various people have come out and defended the use of these methods. I think, you know, to some extent, there's an argument, you know, a real argument here, kind of in favor of torture. I can imagine some cases where it might be useful. But as I've said earlier, I just don't think that anything in the report suggests that those sorts of cases were where torture was used. And I think that's where torture, the people who argue that it might be good for the CIA occasionally to torture people sort of bring up examples where there's a ticking bomb and somebody knows the code to defuse it and you've got to get the information out. It doesn't seem to me that in any of the cases we've seen the situation was anything like that.
Exactly.
Right. The Times had a really interesting piece where they talked about how as the Pentagon and the CIA debated what they should be doing, a prisoner sat in a cell in solitary confinement for 47 days. That doesn't indicate a ticking bomb. And another thing that's just sort of mind-blowing is how the initial plan was to basically put these captured, you know, suspected terrorists in essentially maximum security prisons. So we went somehow from maximum security prisons. The Pentagon didn't want to be in charge of that and ended up in these sort of murky cells with sensory deprivation and all this kind of stuff. It's really a remarkable journey,
so,
but it's one that I think is also about the future, which
is
important.
How does all of this affect former President Bush's legacy? John Dickerson.
Well, I think his argument would be, and the members of the CIA who worked under him would say, that this was a ticking time bomb situation, that there were anthrax attacks, that there were stories of rogue Pakistani nuclear scientists who'd met with al-Qaeda, and that the worry out there was not a specific thing they knew about, but the unspecific stuff that they didn't know about. And that is the foundation of the defense for President Bush and all of those who acted here, which was that this was a moment of extreme new panic and that they had to move quickly because they didn't know what was going on out there. I think that is the national security justification for what happened. I think secondarily, they say once the president found out that this had gone too far, he shut it down. And then I think the third, which is purely crass and political, is that now that this has become a political debate about the release of the report, with Republicans saying, why are you telling these old stories now? It only harms Americans, and Democrats taking the opposite view, it has now gone into the partisan sorting machine. And so any discussion about torture is kind of getting lost in the conversation about whether the report it was done correctly, whether it should have been released. And once it sorts by partisanship, then it's just Republicans will support it and will support President Bush. And sort of that period we had in 2005 where you had Republicans running away from the administration, working together to stop torture, to talk about how bad it was, that was much, much more muted this week, in which people talked about how bad the report was and its release, but didn't talk about the underlying behavior that they used to condemn.
But this, I think it is important to note that this is not just about the Bush legacy, right? We now live in a world where the U.S. is not at war against nation states, right? You're at dealing with groups like ISIS, these sort of shadowy operations. And so that means that you're not having troops on the ground. You're talking about special forces. You're talking about drones. You're talking about special operations. So these kinds of questions of how we handle this brave new world of conflict, they're not going away. And that's why I think this report is relevant going into the future.
At the same time, it does make us question what we stand for and whether we continue to stand for that which we say we stand for. And I think Americans around the country are sending me emails, phone calls, saying, I'm not proud to be an American today.
Well, it's an interest. There are many people who feel that and who feel that acutely. The polling on this, and polling is a fuzzy thing, but has shown that Americans are actually more receptive to the use of torture than they were in 2005 when these first came to light. There's an Associated Press poll that was done in 2005 in which 36% of the people said torture was not to be used in any circumstance. That number is now down into the mid-20s. And we saw in the reaction to the beheadings from ISIL that the nation very quickly rallied behind a kind of go after the bad guys kind of feeling in response to those horrific events. And to the extent that this report is about the treatment of people who were involved, in some cases, the mastermind of horrific events, including 9/11, I think that there is a large group of people out in the public who think this is all bad stuff, but it was being done to bad people who killed thousands of Americans.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's move on and talk about the protests continuing around the country to the grand jury verdicts in New York and Missouri. What kinds of actions are we seeing now, John Prideaux, when you think that this has been sort of weeks old now? It is continuing.
It is continuing, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think it's a good thing that the Senate torture report was published, even if it's somewhat shaming. I think it's a good thing that we've had protests in America, particularly that, you know, obviously I wouldn't support violent protests, but some of the things. I was in New York earlier this week, and there were some, you know, I attended some moving protests. I went to a meeting in Crown Heights where the local police commanders were meeting with, you know, with citizens there and talking
good
about the relationships between the police and the people they you know, are meant to keep safe. And those arguments were pretty heated. I think it's a good thing that this is going on. You know, America's police, frankly, shoot too many people. Too many of them are unarmed. The Department of Justice has some eye-popping reports on this, which I've spent this week reading. And I think it's important for, you know, for Americans to perhaps, you know, rebalance this.
When you say you've spent the last few days reading those reports, give us a sense of what you saw.
The most extraordinary story I came across came from Cleveland, where the police department has been under supervision from the Justice Department. And they described a case where two people were driving in a car past the police headquarters, and the police thought they heard a shot. And in fact, it was probably the car backfiring because nobody in the car was armed. At one point, 60 police vehicles ended up chasing this car. Over 100 officers were involved. It led to a high-speed chase, which wound up in the parking lot, I think, of a school. And some of the police started shooting at the car. The car was entirely surrounded by police officers. The police officers on one side, when they heard a shot, assumed that the people in the car were firing at them. In fact, the police were firing at each other, effectively. They ended up firing 120 bullets, I think, 20 of which ended up in the bodies of each of the people in the car. Nobody was armed. You know, nobody had committed a crime other than, you know, speeding while being chased by 60 police cars. But this was, I mean, that was a sort of extreme example, but there were very many like that. And, of course, America's a very large country, and so you'd expect, you know, a big variation. But, you know, things like that happen too frequently, in my view.
And it was in, and it was also the Cleveland Police Department that, or a member of the Cleveland Police Department that killed the 12-year-old boy with the toy gun.
Right.
I think this week we also, Thursday evening, saw a walk staffers in on the Hill in Congress walk out in protest with their hands up.
Plus, some members of Congress went with them.
And some members, and then we saw completely on the other side of the country this week there have been protests in Berkeley and Oakland related to what's happened in Ferguson and in New York.
John Dickerson of CBS and Slate.com. Going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about this Supreme Court ruling on Amazon workers. Take your calls, your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, now with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. More at Lumosity.com. From Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, broad international condemnation of the Senate's interrogation report, clashes in Israel over the death of a Palestinian government minister, and police in Hong Kong clear protest camps and arrest activists. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you can watch live video this hour of the Friday News Roundup at drshow.org. And here in the studio, John Prideaux of The Economist, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg News, John Dickerson of Slate.com, and CBS. Let's take a call here, 800-433-8850. First to Flora in Arlington, Virginia. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I think our credibility and reliability as a nation that is honorable goes out the window when we commit such atrocities, and they were atrocities. And two of these people were CIA informants. They weren't even guilty of anything.
Do we know that for certain, John Dickerson?
I don't know the specific case that Flora's talking about. The larger argument she makes about Americans' values was one that Senator McCain, the case he made on the floor as a Republican for why it was important to have this report out. And Joe Biden said the report was a badge of honor and its release was a badge of honor as a way to reset those values. One of the arguments of those who opposed the release of the report was this is old news. And yes, there might have been a few details, but this is old news and it's only going to hurt America more. The argument that supporters of the report made is that the American values have been so hurt by this and other things, Abu Ghraib, and that releasing the report shows that no matter how far from the actual event it was, there is still a commitment to strengthening those values, and the commitment is this deep that Democrats are willing to even risk any downside of having the report come forward because they want to reassert that these values are still held important.
Here's a tweet from Charlie who says, "I'm really concerned as to why President Obama has yet to really speak out against directly or for CIA-enhanced interrogation."
Well, I think the president and the White House recognize that if he speaks out, that opens up a whole host of other questions. Were they effective? Should someone be punished? And those are not questions that the White House really wants to answer or necessarily deal with. I also think the president recognizes something that we see often in polling, that should there Americans be harmed, should something happen, the politics of this change on a dime. And people stop talking about what the caller was talking about, credibility and honorability, and start feeling scared and talking about.
And that goes back your point, John, about when the beheadings began. John Perdow.
I also think, as far as the president speaking out, he is, in theory at least, the boss of the CIA. I think he doesn't want to do anything that's seen to demoralize them. When he was mildly critical of the NSA, there was a certain amount of kind of pushback from within the agency saying, well, everyone's terribly demoralized, you know, our boss is being critical of us. I think the president, you know, badly doesn't want to end up in a situation where he gives some encouragement to some people out there who's saying we need to put CIA agents on trial. I think he probably calculates that the report has done its job. You know, I find the arguments that John made quite persuasive, that, you know, it is a kind of statement about America's values that the country is prepared to publish embarrassing things, you know, even if they hurt America's reputation in the short term. That does strengthen the country in the long term. I used to, just very briefly, Dan, I used to be a correspondent in Brazil, and this week the Brazilian government released a report about government torture, but it was called torture in the 1970s. You know, it's taken them 45 years to do it.
Interesting.
I think it's a strength of America that for all the sort of trauma that the country went through after 9/11, which I think, you know, is clearly the background to the CIA doing these things, which felt like they were sort of acceptable at the time because everyone was scared. You know, for all that, the country's to some extent come out of that now and is prepared to sort of face this stuff.
All right, let's go to Ed in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to clear up this point of semantics. Doesn't this report clearly demonstrate that we tortured people? The United States tortured people over a long period of time, and that should be a sort of a historical fact. I don't like calling it enhanced error. No, we tortured people. And the other thing I wanted to mention is I've seen the photos at Slate of the prisoners, and it's sadistic, it's vengeful, it's amateurish, and then facilities where they held these people. It's sadistic, it's vengeful.
All right, Dan, John, do you want to comment?
Well, I think the president himself said we tortured some folks in a previous context, so I think he's He's on the record as saying that, and there are other U.S. officials who are on the record as saying that that was a part of the... So that's the counterbalance to those who would talk about EITs.
Hi to Jeff in Northport, Florida. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Diane. I'm a longtime listener.
Thank you.
Diane, the first point I'd like to make is that I find it very amusing that your panel is completely liberal. You don't have anyone else there other than three liberals sitting at a table talking. None of us, me, you, or all three of you, were part of any of this. None of us know what it's like to deal with these situations. At the end of the day, the report was totally partisan. They didn't even actually speak to the CIA themselves. You've got Dianne Feinstein, who is not exactly the most honest person out there, and we're going to go by her words. At the end of the day, we're dealing with barbaric people. I don't really know. You never bring this up when we talk about this issue. We're dealing with people who are living in the Stone Age. They're barbarians. What they do to their own people over there when they punish people, they stone people. They cut people's hands off. So, I mean, to be completely honest with you, I heard you saying earlier that you've gotten so many people emailing you about how they feel like they're not even American, or they feel un-American. That's a joke. The CIA people, they did the best that they could.
All right, and that's precisely what Vice President Cheney had to say, is the fact that Dianne Feinstein did not have any Republicans supporting this report. Does it undermine its authenticity or its impact, John?
That's the case that Bob Kerrey, the former Democratic senator from Nebraska, made, who has been involved in these kinds of investigations in the past. And his argument was that this puts this report back just into the regular old partisan thing, and that causes people to kind of take a nap, and also it diminishes its power. And so, you know, John McCain comes out in support of the report, but he's really the only one making the full-throated endorsement of it. And
a former prisoner of war.
A former prisoner of war, and in making his case for the release, talked about his experience and mentioned, among other things, we've talked about the values piece, but he also talked about the utilitarian, that you get worse information through torture than if you use other techniques. But the fact that this is a partisan report, Bob Kerrey said that makes it less useful. And I think we're seeing it kind of play out in a way in which the debate is not being engaged and worked through. It's basically both sides to their predictable corners talking past each other.
People are focusing more or as much on the politics than they are on the content of the report itself.
I think that's right. I think after the initial shock of the report, you know, in the first day or two, now it's going through what John said before, which I liked, the partisan sorting machine. But look, this is Washington, right? Politics trumps everything, particularly as we're in this moment where we're moving into a new Congress, we're moving into another presidential race. But those pictures, those graphic images, those graphic descriptions are not going away. So this is something they will have to grapple with
Absolutely.
For a while.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to Sue in Middleville, Michigan. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
It's so good to hear you.
Thank you.
Okay, I have something that has bothered me for quite a while. I think that the younger generation doesn't believe a lot of the stuff that happened at 9/11, 2001. There were thousands, and from the international community, from the police, from the fire people that lost their lives trying to save each other. And I really don't know what the total was, or if anybody has ever even figured it out, how many lives were lost by all of the people, not just the people that were in the tower. And to think that, now I'm not justifying what the torture method. No, but what I am saying is that that came down so hard, and people were, so I'm 73, I remember it vividly, it came down so hard that consequently something had to be done to find out who was behind it, what was going on, why did they do it, yada, yada.
Well, and there's your poll number changing.
Yeah, the last two callers are really a representative, you know, of the hot side of that argument,
sure.
And the more and the cooler side, which is, you know, this was a terrifying moment, and the people who did it, which goes to context for this behavior, and then the people who did it are barbarians. I think the pushback argument from McCain and certainly all the Democrats would be, they are barbarians, and America can distinguish themselves from the barbarians by drawing the line in the way they treat even the most evil among us.
All right, let's talk about the Supreme Court ruling that Amazon does not need to pay workers for time spent in theft prevention screenings. What was the reasoning behind that?
Right. Well, Amazon workers often spend 25 minutes, half an hour in screening lines after the end of their shift. They argue that they should get pay for that time. They have to stay at work.
In other words, they are being screened as they exit so that they're
for stealing
not
or things like that. And that's a fairly common thing in the retail industry, particularly around the holidays. So the Amazon workers argued in a lawsuit that they should be compensated for that time. The company has requiring them to do these screenings. But the legal standard is whether something like that is integral and indispensable to their jobs. And if it is considered integral and indispensable to the jobs, then there's no extra pay. If there's integral and independence to the jobs, then there is extra pay. Sorry about that. If it's not, there is no extra pay.
But how can it not be if they are required to do this?
Right. It does seem, and this was a unanimous decision, right? So in other words, this is, I think, as I understand it from looking at it, it's basically, it's a very strict reading of what is integral and indispensable. So their job was to take boxes and move them. And this testing whether they had slipped anything into their pocket in the course of doing that was not integral and indispensable to the moving of those boxes, and therefore, through that very strict reading, it's not.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
But I think that this ruling in the context of this court is not all that surprising. There's been studies that show that this court is far friendlier to business than any court since at least World War II. So you have a ruling that comes out in favor of Amazon, which has been criticized for a large variety of a number of worker practices. But in the context of this court, I don't think it is all that surprising.
How is it going to or likely to affect other companies, John?
Well, I suppose Amazon's model is being widely imitated throughout American business, and so you would expect it would have some knock-on effect. The thing that sort of astonished me about this case was that it ever got to the Supreme Court, not because of the legal arguments, but it seems very depressing that the workers and the management weren't able to sit down and figure out, you know, some kind of common sense solution to this that everyone would have been happy with. I find it rather sad that it had to go all this way. I hope that, I know this didn't concern warehouses that were sort of directly managed by Amazon. It was, you know, a subcontracted and so forth. But I hope that, you know, the other folks in a similar position do a better job of working these things out so they don't wind up in lawsuits.
All right, to Sally in Houston, Texas. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I would like your panelists' opinions. I'm a Democrat. I've always been. I did not have, nor do I continue to have, a very high opinion of President Bush as a president. But I would not be at all surprised if he did not have deep knowledge of what was going on with the torture aspect, basically because of Dick Cheney. And I just like their opinions of that.
All right. Thanks for your call, Lisa.
Well, that's one issue coming out of this report that has been really murky. It's just not been clear what President Bush knew and when he knew it. Did he know just about that these folks were being interrogated, or did he know about the enhanced air interrogation techniques or the torture? It's not entirely clear. There's been a number of different answers, but it's obviously a very important question.
That's right. President Bush, in his book that it published, Decision Points, published after he left office, said he knew in 2002. That's what Dick Cheney said this week. But George Tenet, the director of the CIA under George Bush, said that he informed Bush about waterboarding, the torture, in 2006. So it's possible for both to be right. And that's, again, back in the murkiness of, well, we're talking about the interrogation program, which was kicked off shortly after 9/11. But we're also talking about the specific behavior within that program that crossed the line. And what when one started and one ended is still a matter of debate, so many years later.
So how many months, years is this conversation about torture likely to go on? Or is it likely because of the politics to simply fade?
I think it fades. I think it changes to a debate about drones, because drones are still being used, whereas this torture what we've discussed during the show is gone mostly. So I think it moves on to a debate about drones.
I think it stays alive in the off chance that there is any kind of Democratic presidential primary. I think it's something that Democratic base cares a lot about. I think it stays alive there for sure. And, you know, we're going to have a number of presidential debates. It's an awfully interesting question for moderators. I think it stays alive in that way.
I would add also, yes, the president's executive order against the use of these techniques could be undone by a next president, and that surely could be a question for the next one.
John Dickerson, he's also the author of On Her Trail, My Mother, Nancy Dickerson, TV News First Woman Star. Lisa Lehrer, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. John Prideaux, Washington correspondent for The Economist. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Diane.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.